Hello, I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this Tuesday afternoon. The first hour of our program today, measles was pronounced eradicated in this country as recently as the year 2000. But here we are in 2015, and we may have more cases of measles this year than we had last year, when there were 644 cases in 27 states, according to the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention. Why is this? Why are some parents refusing to immunize their children against certain diseases? Well, we see polio, an increase in polio and people contracting polio because other people are not getting their children immunized. We're going to talk about this whole issue this first hour of our program today. We'll be starting with a producer at this very interesting news organization, Retro Report. It's a documentary news organization formed in 2013 as a counterweight to the 24/7 news cycle. Later in the hour, not too much later in the hour, our guest will be an American pediatrician who specializes in infectious diseases and is an expert on vaccines, immunology, a member of the Advisory Committee on Immunization Practices for the CDC, and also a founding advisory board member to the Autism Science Foundation. Welcoming phone calls on vaccination this hour of the program. You can reach us, as you always can, at 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. The email is talk at WPR.org. Facebook page, where we already have quite a few comments interesting to read, is the Kathleen Dunn Show, and we are on Twitter as well, and Twitter is at K Dunn Show. Joining us at the top of the show, Bonnie Bertram. Bonnie is a producer at Retro Report, and we do have the report on our Facebook page. It's well worth watching because it looks at what the controversy is now and looks at news reports going back to when it was announced that measles had been pretty much eradicated in the United States. Bonnie is has been a consultant and a producer for CNN, for Time, Fortune magazine, has published for the International Herald Tribune, the Atlanta Journal-Constitution, Spy Magazine, 17, Premier Magazine, and many others. And we welcome you, Bonnie, and thank you so much for being with us.
Oh, my pleasure, Kathleen. Nice to join you.
First, congratulations on this site. I must say, I was not aware of it, and it's terrific. What a great thing you're doing.
Oh, great. Yeah, thanks for checking us out. Yeah, we set out to be sort of a slow news organization, which is sort of counterintuitive because news moves so quickly today. And we thought, wouldn't it be interesting if instead of, you know, getting caught up and reporting it as fast and as quickly as we could, we looked back at stories that were in the news and examined sort of how did we get to this place where we are?
Yeah.
Vaccines is sort of a perfect example of that. I mean, none of us could have foretold this measles outbreak, but last spring, I started looking into this story and why it is that sometimes people's personal beliefs are so powerful that they can't really understand the science that have been proven definitively that vaccines do not cause autism. And lo and behold, I was, you know, plugging along on my story, and then the measles outbreak happened.
Oh, my.
Our slow news organization became what for us was a fast news organization.
Exactly.
Well, so, I tried to sort of take the position with our story that we were sort of post-debate because really in the last several years in particular, Dr. Andrew Wakefield, who was the doctor who led the study at the Royal Free Hospital in the UK, who thought that there could be this connection between a bowel disorder that was linked to autism and the measles component of the triple MMR vaccine, wrote a paper that was published in this very respected medical journal called The Lancet, where he said there might be this connection, we need to look into it, which seems pretty reasonable. But what happened was that the hospital held a press conference, and in this press conference, Dr. Wakefield went above and beyond what he had published in The Lancet, and he basically said, until we know more about this, you should not give your kid the combination vaccine.
Oh, he did.
He did. And so that set off a media scare. And, you know, parents, I myself am guilty of this, fear often clouds your judgment so profoundly that
sure.
When you say, oh, maybe there's a link, we should look into this, your first reaction is, you know, oh, I know, where there's smoke, there's fire. And so a lot of people in the UK backed off getting the vaccine, and they're still suffering from measles in the UK, primarily because of this thoroughly debunked article in The Lancet. But that was one thing that that triggered this scare, and The Lancet retracted the article, and Dr. Wakefield lost his license to practice medicine. So it's really been pretty thoroughly devalued. He's been called a fraud, and yet still people cling to this belief. So I thought, what is it? You know, what is it that makes people unable to look at this and sort of see what the science is saying so clearly and so profoundly? And I also wanted to look at the role the media played, because
yes.
What happened was some celebrities, primarily Jenny McCarthy, whose son has or had autism, started to say, hey, we need to look at this more carefully. And in fact, sort of took it further than that. But sometimes just by raising that question, just by saying, and I'm glad I noticed you did not say this in your introduction, just by posing the question, are vaccines safe?
Mm-hmm.
The intimation is that, no, they're not safe.
Mm-hmm.
So for somebody like Jenny McCarthy to go on a show like Oprah or CNN's Larry King Live and say, look, you know, we vaccinated my kid and now we've lost him. He's not the same child he used to be. It had a really profound effect on a lot of parents who were trying to carefully weigh this decision about whether they wanted to vaccinate their child or not. So I primarily looked at two things. Why that Lancet journal continues to have traction even though it's been so debunked, and what happened, what role did the media play by posing a question seemingly innocently, but in fact not so innocently at all, and then presenting it as a, well, here's somebody who's a celebrity who has a very powerful personal story, and let's stack that up against some doctors. And what you could see in my piece play out pretty clearly is that doctors are trained to parse their language. And if you're a scientist, you can never say anything with absolute certainty because you don't live in that world. It's not part of your DNA. So when you have a doctor, it sounds like they're equivocating when they're saying, well, to the best of our knowledge, there is no link, which is what a scientist would say. They can never say, I promise you, I guarantee you 100% truthful, there's no link, because it's not how science works. So when you stack somebody like Jenny McCarthy up on Oprah with a doctor who says, well, I can tell you right now, to the best of my knowledge, the evidence doesn't show that, it creates this funny sense of false balance that I think sort of misinformed and misled a lot of viewers and a lot of people.
And it's amazing how wide-reaching it was. You also have a clip with Dr. Nancy Snyderman with Matt Lauer, and he's talking about this as a controversial issue of vaccination, and she really takes him to task, saying it's not controversial. Vaccinate.
She does. And, I mean, it just shows you how potent all of this is, because to present it as a controversy would also suggest that there's validity to both sides of the argument. And scientifically and medically, all of the things that we trust in ever since we've known, you know, the world is not flat, all of the things that science points us to show that there is no connection between autism and the MMR vaccine, and yet it's presented as a controversy. And I worked in news, and I know that it's the inclination of a news director. Controversy sells. And
right.
So if I come out and I have some doctor, and pardon Dr. Offit, your next guest, he's terrific, but most doctors are not as eloquent as he is. So if I put, you know, a public health official who's not as great as Dr. Offit on the air, and he says in his monotone, I can tell you right now, vaccines seem to be safe.
Mm-hmm.
It's not going to play the same way Jenny McCarthy, who's like beautiful and intelligent, coming on and saying, my son, something happened to him. It just doesn't get the same traction.
Well, then add this element, which is fairly recent, of New Jersey Governor Chris Christie saying the government should give parents a measure of choice over whether or not to vaccinate. He cites a perceived danger from shots that guard against measles. You've got Senator Rand Paul, who said that shots should be voluntary after he heard of many, I quote, tragic cases where children develop profound mental disorders after vaccines. And then they took heat from Democrats and Republicans and changed their minds, saying that they did support vaccination. So you add this political element, and oh, brother, it really adds another layer of confusion, huh?
Yeah, and again, it was that same thing. You'll notice he said, I heard stories from parent after
right.
parent. And that's, again, what happens in this. And we probably know people. I have a good friend who has a child who she claims suffered from a vaccine injury, and it's just one of those things I can't talk to her about. And I think that what happens is these anecdotes get traction. And to be fair, that is how issues are often flagged in the medical community. Something warrants research when all of a sudden there are these things happening. So that's an okay thing. For that to happen, that's normal. That's supposed to be how scientists go about finding what's going on and how vaccines are being received. But once something has been studied to the tune of hundreds of thousands, if not millions of people, and they say this link is not real, it really does medicine a disservice to keep saying, well, it has to be real. And all of the energy and money and time that's been lost in pursuing this connection that science has proven is not there is a real loss for people who want to find the root cause behind autism, because it is very scary the way the numbers are growing. And I think New Jersey has one of the highest rates of autism, if not the highest in the country. And, these are all well-meaning parents who want to do right by their children. And you can see them falling under this spell almost so easily, but it's dangerous. And it's dangerous from a public health perspective, not just in terms of endangering their own children, but this other notion of herd immunity, where a certain percentage of people need to be vaccinated to stop the disease in its tracks. So for me, when Governor Christie came out and said that, he must have known it was a completely loaded thing to say, and I can't for the life of me understand why somebody who wanted to become president would make a comment like that about public health that was, a provocative thing to say.
Yes, it was. There's no doubt about that. The other dramatic thing in the video that we put on our Facebook page that you put together is just this very short statement by, I believe it was Jane Pauley, back in the year 2000 or 2001, saying, "Good news, we've reached a point where we have eradicated measles in the United States." It wasn't that long ago she said it, and look where we are today.
I know, right? It's like walking back the hands of time. It's just kind of stunning. I mean, this is something, I'm a journalist, so I, stay with the story and live with it for several months. But for people in the medical community, I can imagine this is so incredibly disheartening. And Sanjay Gupta from CNN wrote a piece, I think it was for their blog, and he said, "I hesitate to write this because I don't want it to be considered an editorial or an opinion piece. There is no editorializing the scientific truth that vaccines are safe and they're good for you and they're good for the public." So, I can only imagine what it's like for, like, the doctor who I interviewed in Marin County, California, which has, in some schools, a low, very low uptake percentage. And, for someone to come in and say, "Well, I know you went to medical school, and I know you've made this your life's work, but, I saw something on the Internet. I don't think I'm going to vaccinate." Right? I mean, your heart just breaks for those people because, they've dedicated their lives. And like I said, Dr. Offit, too. I mean, these people are really out there trying to do what science shows is the right thing to do, and they're frankly getting a lot of grief for it. And I will tell you too, in researching some of these clips, I reached out to Dr. Offit and called him because I was so appalled by the way he was treated, because a certain TV anchor, paraphrasing another person, said, "Some people call you X," and it was a horrible thing.
Oh my goodness.
For a news anchor to take somebody's words and just even say "other people call you this," but what goes out is that people have called him this terrible thing, puts him in such a terrible position that I felt terrible as a journalist that he had been put in that position.
Right. Well, do you have a sense that things may be changing? Because you would think that those people who have not vaccinated their children, and they know somebody now in a daycare center down the street from their house, or they see these reports of the hundreds of cases that we have in this country, do you think that people are doing some self-examination who have bought into this anti-vaccine movement and saying, maybe I was wrong?
Well, so like I said, I live with these stories for a matter of months. But for people who've really made this, a passion of theirs for years, I was very excited by this because I thought, maybe the tide is turning. And they said, in 2 years from now, we'll be back where we were. I mean, they were very cynical and probably more realistic about it. But one thing that's important to remember is that nationwide, vaccination rates are pretty high. But the issue is there are these small enclaves, these small communities where it's low, Marin County, California being one of them, and a lot of places, frankly, in California. Humboldt County is low, Orange County is low, where it's low enough that the disease really can spread, and that's what's frightening. So it's important to recognize that these people who don't vaccinate are not the majority, and they are a bit of a fringe group. So, you know, we shouldn't give the impression that there are a lot of these people who aren't vaccinating. The vast majority of Americans, like 90%, are vaccinated. So,
what's going on in California?
Well, I think that there, the doctor that I spoke with in Marin County, when I called the public health, official in California, and I said, "Why do you think Marin County in particular has a problem?" And he sort of paused, and he said, "Well, these are people who would self-identify as exceptional." And so I thought, okay, I think what he's trying to tell me is these are people who feel like it's okay for other kids to get vaccinated, but not their own. This is a community that says, and again, I'm talking in broad strokes here because I certainly know many people in Marin County who are vaccinated, and I happen to be from there. So, but I do know that there is an element of people who will go online. They're bright people who go online, they'll do some research for themselves, and they'll say, this is scary, and I think I'm not going to do this. So when the guy, I think, was speaking to me, that these are people who would self-identify as exceptional, he was indicating a kind of person who falls into some sort of a political rubric. In California, there are certainly other areas where, for religious reasons, people don't vaccinate, and there have been problems in those areas, too, or ethnic areas where people don't vaccinate. But I think in California, and this is where it gets tricky because, you know, these are parents who really do want to do the right thing for their children, and they're smart parents, and they're making choices, however, that put the public health at risk. So, you know, it's hard to say why, but anecdotally, and again, I'm falling into my own trap by citing anecdotes as evidence, but I think that there is a percentage of upper middle class, highly educated people who feel like this is something that doesn't need to apply to them.
Right. So before we move to Dr. Offit, just tell me a little more about the retro report, how people can access this, how often you're dealing with stories that take us past, you know, a few days or so, 24/7, that what happened yesterday, it doesn't apply today anymore. Exactly.
Well, so we are distributed on the New York Times website, but we also have our own website, retroreport.org. And we've done stories about the crack baby epidemic, which in hindsight proved to be no such thing. I was working on a story over the summer about SWAT teams and how they've proliferated, and then Ferguson, Missouri happened, and all of a sudden we were shocked to see these people. So that was another example of that story being front and center in the news, but we sort of really took the long view and walked people through how it is that they've become used in a different way than they were originally intended for. So, you know, we try to provide context and a longer view to stories that inform our world today.
The thing that many newspapers used to do.
Right. That's right. It's you know, in this Twitter 140-character news world, we're sort of the opposite of that.
Right. Well, I'm glad you exist. Bonnie, thank you so much for
my pleasure,
your reporting and taking on this issue. Bonnie Bertram, our first guest producer at Retro Report, they have done, it's about a 12-minute documentary that looks at the new cases of measles in this country that goes back to about the year, well, it goes before that, but the year 2000, and looked at how the press covered the announcement of the eradication of measles in this country, and then looks at why it is that some parents have not immunized their children, the debunking of the British doctor who wrote a piece in Lancet, a respected medical journal, saying that he saw a problem, and then he was totally discredited, and yet people held on to this belief, and the role of the media, lots of different shows who were saying, there's a concern here, and just mostly talking to parents who thought there was a concern and for whatever reason saw a link between vaccinations and their children's autism, which has been debunked, and yet it caught hold and is still there, and as a result, we have measles again. Well, the next part of the program, we are going to be speaking with a highly respected American pediatrician who specializes in infectious diseases, and we'll meet him and take your phone calls. We have many of them. Just bear with us for a moment, and we'll be with him, and then we'll be with you. Our phone number is 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. Our email is talk@wpr.org. Facebook page, go there, because we've got the retro report there, and it's worth seeing, is the Kathleen Dunn Show. And this is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Dr. Paul Offit joins us now, Chief of the Division of Infectious Diseases and the Director of the Vaccine Education Center at Children's Hospital of Philadelphia, also Professor of Vaccinology and a Professor of Pediatrics at the University of Penn School of Medicine. He is the co-inventor of the rotavirus vaccine, which protects children from severe diarrhea, young children and infants. It protects them. It's recommended for universal use in infants by the CDC. He has won many, many awards for outstanding service. He's the author of 5 medical narratives, including Vaccinated, One Man's Quest to Defeat the World's Deadliest Diseases, Autism's False Prophets, Bad Science, Risky Medicine, and the Search for a Cure, Deadly Choices, How the Anti-Vaccine Movement Threatens Us All, and Do You Believe in Magic? The Sense and Nonsense of Alternative Medicine. We'll be welcoming phone calls for him. Dr. Paul Offit, thank you very much for being with us.
Thank you.
Let's start with a question that you ask in one of your books, or give me the answer to it. How does the anti-vaccine movement threaten all of us?
Well, you know, when people choose not to vaccinate their children, they put not only their own children at risk, but those with whom they come in contact. I think you probably have no better example for that than the 121 cases of measles that are currently occurring in the United States. That's a rate more than twice last year, which was the biggest outbreak we've had in 20 years. So herd immunity is eroding, and we all suffer.
And do you worry that we're going to see an emergence of other kinds of diseases we thought were eradicated?
Yeah, so as a general rule, you could argue that measles is the canary in the mine of the vaccine program, because it's a great vaccine and it's a highly contagious disease. So when you start to see any sort of erosion in herd immunity, that's when you see measles come back. You'd have to have further erosion in herd immunity to see arguably more emotional diseases like polio or diphtheria come back, but, you know, it's certainly not a good sign.
Mm-hmm. And tell me where you think this all came from. Why is it that people would not vaccinate their children? Does it go back to that doctor who's not even a doctor anymore in England?
I think that certainly hurt. But I think at the heart of it, frankly, is people aren't scared of the disease. I mean, you know, my parents were children in the 20s and 30s. They saw diphtheria as a common killer of teenagers. I mean, I was a child of the 50s, and I mean, I was in a polio ward when I was 5 years old. I mean, I certainly realized what polio was and could do. And my children, who are 22 and 20, not only don't see these diseases, say they didn't grow up with them. And frankly, young doctors didn't grow up with these diseases either. And they, I think, become at some level less passionate advocates for these vaccines. So I think it's just, you know, we're compelled by fear more than reason, and we don't fear the diseases.
Give me a little bit of the history, and let's start with the measles, mumps, rubella vaccine, which is front and center now in our discussions. When was it developed? Was it universally embraced at that point? And how successful was it in eradicating measles in this country and perhaps in other parts of the world?
Right, so the measles vaccine came into the United States in 1963, the mumps vaccine in 67, the last best measles vaccine in 68, and then the rubella vaccine in 69. We combined those vaccines into a single shot so the children could get one shot instead of three in 1971, and the vaccine was remarkably successful. Before there was a vaccine, and as far as measles is concerned, we had 3 to 4 million cases every year, 48,000 hospitalizations every year, and, you know, upwards of 500 deaths every year. That vaccine eliminated the disease from this country by the year 2000. Unfortunately, you know, it's coming back because we just don't fear it. I think you hear some of this sort of the people on TV now, I mean, some of the either TV or radio, you know, these sort of Southern California doctors who will say, well, you know, measles is not a big deal. I can only imagine they have never seen measles, because measles is quite a big deal. Measles makes you sick and can kill you.
Mm-hmm. Measles does kill people. I remember getting measles when I was a young kid. I was 666. A lot of us who are of a certain age remember getting it.
Right. I remember it, too.
Yeah. So tell me about what you think the role of the press is in disseminating terribly erroneous information and making this link between this shot and the high rate of autism in this country. Are we to blame for this? Are politicians to blame for this? Yes. Okay. Yes,
you are. I mean, yes. The way I see it is that here's a man who published a paper in 1998, which was, I mean, in defense of the press, was published in a reputable journal, The Lancet. And one would assume there'd been some vetting before that article was published. If you looked at the article, just even cursorily looked at the article, you would see that it was really not a study. It was just a case series of 8 children who had received the MMR that then developed autism. That's a fantastic claim. I mean, at best it was a hypothesis, but it was an extraordinary claim. And if you believe Carl Sagan, and I do, extraordinary claims should be backed up by extraordinary evidence. This was an extraordinary claim backed up by no evidence. At the very least, what I think the media should have done was step back and say, let's just see if anyone can reproduce this finding, and no one could. And when they did real studies, which this wasn't, you saw that you were at no greater risk of getting autism if you got the vaccine or if you didn't. And I just think, you know, when you attack a vaccine program, you know, that's serious business. And, you know, children died as a consequence. So I do blame the media. I think they have to be a little circumspect when it's just one outrageous claim.
Mm-hmm. And then you have these people. I don't even know who this woman was. She was a Playmate bunny at some point. She was on Oprah and various shows saying that her son had autism and he got that because he had a shot. And, well, what evidence do you have? My evidence is at home. And she's all over these TV talk shows. And a lot of people watch those. And she's, you know, compelling to watch. And I guess we're gullible, huh?
Well, I think, I mean, celebrities are given a platform. We think we know them because we sort of see them all the time in one format or another, big screen, little screen. And so at some level, we trust them. And so when she tells a heartfelt story, my child was fine, got this vaccine, then the soul left his eyes, at some level, we want to believe her. She was wrong. I think she knows she was wrong. I mean, she's sort of out. Jenny McCarthy really doesn't comment on vaccines anymore. I think she would be much braver if she stood up and would make a difference if she stood up and said, look, I was wrong. I made a mistake. I think, you know, no doubt some children suffered my mistake, and I just really want to apologize to the public.
Well, she should do that. I wonder if anybody's asked her.
Why don't you ask her?
No, you should ask her. You have more weight than I do.
We're not that close. I don't know what happened.
I understand. So tell me what the national rate of vaccination needs to be and what the rate needs to be in each community to make sure that people will be protected against measles or other diseases, infectious diseases.
Right, so the rate is determined by the contagiousness of the disease. So with measles, which is a highly contagious infection, you really need to have immunization rates upwards of the mid-90% range to prevent spread. And that's why even with decent immunization rates in the United States, we're in the sort of high 80, low 90% range, you start to see outbreaks in certain communities that have, you know, fallen below a critical level. You would have to see actually a further drop in immunization rates to start to see diseases like polio or diphtheria come back. But there are, you know, as was recently reported, there are elementary schools in Southern California, wealthy areas like Beverly Hills or Marina Del Rey or Santa Monica, you know, where immunization rates in the elementary school are 50%.
Unbelievable. And how do you explain that? These are highly educated, very wealthy communities.
I think they think they're above it, that if they just, you know, they live the healthy lifestyle, they shop at Whole Foods, they watch their vitamins and supplements, and so they're so healthy that they can't possibly get these diseases, which, of course, is false thinking.
Mm. All right, let's go to phone calls. Our number is 800-486-8655. Dr. Paul Offit is our guest, chief of the Division of Infectious Diseases and the director of the Vaccine Education Center at Children's Hospital of Philadelphia. He's a professor of vaccinology, a professor of pediatrics at University of Penn School of Medicine. He developed the rotavirus vaccine, and he has written a number of books, including how the Deadly Choices, How the Anti-Vaccine Movement Threatens Us All. Our phone number is 800-486-8655. Raymond in Milwaukee, hello.
Yeah, I'm going to come at this from a different angle. I was brought up as a Jehovah's Witness. I received zero vaccines, but I was born in 1961, and I went to school with quite a few children who did get the measles. Now, you just mentioned there at a high point, there were 500 deaths a year. There were no deaths in my school from the measles, and there was no autism. Now, these parents who are saying we had normal children until they received these shots that had methyl mercury as a preservative, then our child changed. It might have been autism. They're discussing a whole range of different problems that happened after receiving methyl mercury. Now, the reason people don't believe scientists today is because the same scientists that said, do not worry about Ebola, let's bring these patients here to America, well, it did start to spread here. There were two nurses, and it's just by the luck of God that that didn't go further. Those nurses were on airplanes, blah, blah,
okay.
blah.
Okay, all right, let's get a response. Dr. Offit.
Right, so it's perfectly reasonable for a parent to ask the question, my child got a vaccine, now they aren't fine, they were fine before the vaccine, could the vaccine have done it? Those are testable questions, and first of all, children have never, ever received methylmercury in vaccines. They've received ethylmercury, which is a very different product. It's a bigger molecule, and it's excreted from the body about 10 times quicker than methylmercury, which is environmental mercury. You're actually exposed to far more methylmercury in infant formula and breast milk, assuming you live on this planet and drink anything made from water on this planet, than you're ever going to get from a vaccine, which is why it never made sense that ethylmercury preservatives in vaccines would ever cause neurological problems, and now we have seven clear studies that show that they don't. I think what's interesting to me, and I think this is really at the heart of this problem, is which your caller alludes to, is that it's fine for a parent to ask the question, and then I think it's up to the academic community and public health community to respond by doing excellent retrospective controlled studies to isolate the variable of vaccine receipt to see whether it made a difference. When they do those studies, when they spend tens of millions of dollars doing those studies and prove that the vaccine wasn't the cause of whatever problem the parent was worried about, then the parent still doesn't believe them. That's when they cross the line from skeptic to cynic. That's when they cross the line into the world of conspiracy theory. You know, that there's this vast international conspiracy to hide the truth that's driven by pharmaceutical companies, and I just have no respect for that.
Mm-hmm. Are scientists, people in your profession, to blame for not being as adamant as they should be when it comes to vaccination, using phrases like, to the best of our knowledge, when you consider, all things considered, those kinds of phrases instead of, this is what the scientific evidence says, get vaccinated?
You know, at some level, scientists are a victim of the scientific method. I mean, the scientific method, the way that works is you form a null hypothesis, MMR doesn't cause autism, for example, which you can either reject or not reject. What you can never do is you can never accept a null hypothesis, which is to say you can never prove never. All you can say by the scientific method, excuse me, is that, you know, that one event is or isn't associated with another at a certain level of statistical significance. I can't prove that I can't, you know, wave my arms and fly. I can only say that I've tried a certain number of times and haven't been able to do it. So that's where scientists come from. But you're right. When they intersect then with the media, they have to get better at saying things like MMR doesn't cause autism because it doesn't, even though the scientific method really doesn't allow them to ever offer a definitive proof.
I see. Thanks, Raymond, for the call. Mary is next in La Crosse. Hi, Mary.
Hi. I hope I'm remembering something correctly, and I'm asking you this. They talk about children dying from measles, but in the early 60s, my husband and I and our young family lived in Watertown, Massachusetts, just down the street from Perkins School for the Blind. And if my recollection is correct, many of those children there were blind due to measles affecting their cornea. And I remember having the what they called it, two-week measles in those days, staying in my bedroom with the black green shades pulled down because of its effect on because measles could affect our eyes. So I wonder if I'm misremembering that or if that hasn't come up as a side effect of measles.
No, you're right. Measles can cause eye damage. You may also be thinking of rubella virus, which is the so-called German measles, which when the mother was infected with rubella in the first or second trimester, could deliver children who had to have permanent eye or ear or heart defects as well. But you know, the point, you know, people die of measles. Just to go back to the other caller as well. I lived through the 1991 Philadelphia measles epidemic, where we had 1,400 cases and
Ooh.
Nine deaths. In a 5-month period.
Oh, my goodness. In 1991.
So this 30 years in the development of the measles vaccine. I mean, it happened to center on two fundamentalist churches in the city that that chose not to vaccinate their children. I actually wrote an op-ed piece in the New York Times that was published today that described that epidemic to some extent. But it was, you know, anybody who lived through that epidemic was scarred by it. And when people tell me children don't die of measles, they weren't here in 1991.
No, they weren't. Laura on Facebook says, my five-week-old son died of pertussis in 2005. I have very little tolerance for this anti-vaccination attitude. Ask people, how many children do you know who are walking around with leg braces due to polio? Or how many children have you seen cough until they turn black with whooping cough? Very few of us have seen any of these in modern-day America, but those of us who have know how absolutely horrendous these diseases are. Vaccines are a victim of their own success.
Yeah, I'm with Laura. I think, you know, we're taught sort of in medical school and in residency training to be calm and patient and you know, to accept all, be open-minded to all attitudes and beliefs, and I think that's good to a point. But when you train, when you're someone like Laura who had to experience, you know, the worst thing imaginable, mm-hmm. which is losing a child, or when you work in a hospital where you see children die occasionally of vaccine-preventable diseases, which is true at least once a year in our hospital, you know, you get a lot less tolerant, and you become really upset when, you know, when people give false information about vaccine, which causes parents to make bad choices, which can hurt their children. It's just not okay.
Thanks very much for the call. Christine in Wausau. Hi.
Hi. I have a question. Why did they go from the sugar cube polio vaccine back to the shot? And my second question is, our family has a significant number of medication allergies, food allergies, dye allergies, and I do have a concern about a new grandbaby getting a vaccine. And do you recommend anything but the standard sequence of shots? And I'll take my answer offline.
Thanks, Christine.
Okay, so there were three questions there. The reason we went from the sugar cube vaccine, which was the so-called oral polio vaccine, the one that you took by mouth, to the shot, was that the oral polio vaccine, while it was an excellent vaccine and essentially eliminated polio from the United States, it was itself a rare cause of polio. I mean, every year that vaccine virus could actually revert to a so-called neurovirulent virus, and 6 to 8 children every year got polio from the polio vaccine. It occurred in roughly 1 point for every 2.4 million doses. It was rare, but it was real. And so because the so-called inactivated vaccine, the Salk vaccine, also worked well, we went back to that vaccine in 1999-2000 for that reason. In terms of allergies that you mentioned, the one product that is used as a stabilizer in vaccines that certainly can be allergenic is something called gelatin. It's contained in the varicella vaccine. It's contained in the nasal spray flu vaccine. That would be the one thing I would worry about. There are also egg proteins in both the influenza and yellow fever vaccine, but the quantity of egg proteins is so small that even children with severe egg allergies, it seems, can get them. So they've gotten better about that. In terms of the sequence of vaccines, it's the tested schedule. You can't put a vaccine onto the schedule unless you show that it doesn't interfere with the existing vaccines, immunogenicity or safety, and vice versa. It's a well-tested, well-hewn schedule. And I know it's hard to watch children get, you know, as much as 4 or 5 shots at once, but certainly immunologically they can handle it. They better be able to handle it. They're exposed to far more in the way of immunological challenges every day than they're ever getting in vaccines. So, stick with the schedule that has been shown to work and that is approved.
Sean on Facebook says, now that easily preventable diseases are again getting a foothold in our society, what are the chances these diseases could mutate and infect already vaccinated Americans?
Well, I wouldn't say mutate. I mean, I would say measles is a perfect example. Measles has been around, you know, since we first described the disease in the 1700s. It's never really mutated, even though it could. It never has. And it's really just one serotype that causes disease. The problem for the vaccinated person is that no vaccines are 100% effective. So the measles vaccine, which is excellent, you know, affords 95% protection. That means 95 of 100 people who get that vaccine are protected, but 5 aren't. So if there's a measles epidemic, you know, you could be one of those 5. That's really the problem. I think people don't quite understand that. Some of the times the anti-vaccine people will say, look, what do you care what I do? I mean, as long as you're vaccinated, you're protected. That's not true. Nothing in few things in medicine are 100%, and certainly vaccines are one of them.
Stella, Sturgeon Bay. Hi.
Hi. I would like to ask a question I've never heard addressed in discussions about vaccines. Are the vaccines that are given to children non-adjuvant vaccines, i.e. they don't have foreign substances added to them in order to supposedly stimulate the immune system?
Are you asking whether people get vaccines that don't have adjuvants?
Yes.
Yes, there are vaccines that don't have adjuvants.
Are all vaccines given non-adjuvant, or are there vaccines that are given that do have adjuvants?
So there are vaccines that are given that do and don't have adjuvants. The purpose of adjuvants, and usually it's an aluminum salt, is the purpose of that is to lessen the number of doses that you get, or lessen the amount of so-called antigen, the active ingredient that's in vaccines. But aluminum is a light metal. It's the nearest crust. We're all exposed to logarithmically greater quantities of aluminum than you're ever going to get in vaccines, assuming you live on the planet Earth.
And we'll take more phone calls in a moment. Dr. Paul Offit is our guest. He is chief of the Division of Infectious Diseases, director of the Vaccine Education Center at Children's Hospital of Philadelphia, professor of vaccinology, professor of pediatrics at University of Penn School of Medicine, co-inventor of the rotavirus vaccine. He has won all kinds of awards all over the world, and he has a piece in today's New York Times that looks at how bad measles can be and has been in this country. More phone calls in a moment. Our number is 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. The email is talk@wpr.org. Facebook page, The Kathleen Dunn Show, and Twitter at K Dunn Show. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Dr. Paul Offit is our guest now, and we're going to more phone calls. Bill in Madison is next. Hi, Bill.
Hi, Bill here. Yes, thanks for taking my call.
Mm-hmm.
Just a question here. One of the things that I find really interesting about this discussion and the whole debate about vaccines is that, considering what Professor Offit has said, science can't actually prove anything, if I'm getting that right.
Yes.
Then it's very interesting to consider those things that people choose to disbelieve.
Right.
which seems a very select group of things. It's vaccines. Currently, there's a thing about grains, for example. Both of these things strike me as reflecting a kind of a sense of mistrust of culture or even civilization. And I just think it might be interesting to look at the psychology of this repertoire, these select items that emerge as kind of taboos.
It's a very interesting point, actually. I mean, it's, and while science can't technically, literally prove anything, there are no proofs, arguably with the exception of mathematics, there are truths that emerge. I mean, the Earth revolves around the sun, gravity isn't a theory anymore, nor is evolution. So, I mean, there are certain truths that clearly have emerged. But you're right, there's a certain level of scientific denialism. Maybe it's just sort of this postmodern thinking that, if I have a certain belief or attitude, that belief is just as good as anybody who has an expertise and, an experience well beyond what I have, but simply because I have it, it's true. And this applies to, to GMOs, fluoridation, global warming, and vaccines. It's the frustrating thing for me is when you just can't get people to believe the science. It's just, it's too bad because, science did bring us out of the age of darkness into the age of enlightenment. We shouldn't be too quick to go back.
Thank you, Bill, so much for your call. Let's go next to Donald in Wisconsin. Hi, Donald.
Hello.
Hi.
I'm curious if I could maybe be pointed to some articles or some studies of pointing out the fact how many children with autism did not receive a vaccine shot, or do all children with autism, have they received vaccine shots? I mean, are there any studies to that effect?
Many. So autism is kind of, with regarding vaccines, has gone through sort of several iterations. It started with the notion that MMR causes autism. It's very easy to do studies where you look at large numbers of children who did or didn't get that vaccine to make sure those two groups are alike in all other aspects, socioeconomic background, healthcare-seeking behavior, medical background. So you can isolate the effect of that one variable, which is the receipt of the MMR vaccine. When you do those studies, it's very clear and consistent and reproducible that MMR doesn't increase your risk of autism. You can do the same thing with children who got thimerosal-containing vaccines, which is an ethylmercury-containing vaccine, and compare them to children who got the same vaccines that didn't contain ethylmercury to see whether there's any difference in neurodevelopmental outcome, and there's not. There's been about 7 studies. And then more recently, there's a couple studies retrospectively, obviously, because they can only be done retrospectively, looking at children who got sort of the standard recommendation and number of vaccines compared to those whose parents had chosen to delay vaccines till 2 years of age. And again, no difference. I mean, it's interesting. There's a lot of interesting studies on autism, looking at genetics, looking at what kinds of proteins aren't made correctly and when they're not made correctly. And no one ever talks about that. I really think, you know, the anti-vaccine people have really hurt those parents and children with parents of children with autism and the children themselves by diverting this story into this sort of fruitless dead-end hypothesis that never made sense to begin with and certainly hasn't been borne out.
Here's a Facebook comment, or an email, actually, giving some blame to the medical system. Paul says that the U.S. medical system has done a lot to engender patient distrust, hidden and discouraged negative drug efficacy and effects, hidden and outrageous costs, fee-for-service as opposed to a focus on outcome. I don't think this problem, he says, can be laid solely at the feet of the parents involved. Instead of a healthcare system, we have a profit-maximizing rumor mill.
Well, I mean, it's always about the data. I mean, if the argument is that, and I'm not disagreeing, I mean, certainly it's the medicine is imperfect, and, you know, pharmaceutical companies are in it to make money. There's nothing hidden there. The question is, in this case, I mean, if you have a question about whether a vaccine's caused a particular problem, where are the data? Where are the data that show that your problem is, that the problem you're concerned about is real or not real? And look at the data, look at the quality of the studies and the reproducibility of the studies. I think it's okay to be skeptical here, but I do think you cross the line into cynicism when you go, well, I don't trust any of it. I mean, then what's the point? What's the point of even trying to address the questions parents have?
Yeah. You have developed a vaccine. Tell me about the laborious process it is and how long it takes to develop a measles vaccine or the vaccine that you invented.
Well, the measles vaccine was developed, you know, in the 1960s. So that was the time when the FDA, the bar that was held by the FDA was much lower in terms of the number of children that had to be studied pre-licensure. I mean, now you have, you know, this vaccine is obviously being given to hundreds of millions of children, so you have a ton of data. But so it's about 10 years for our vaccine.
Oh,
here
my.
At Children's Hospital Philadelphia. It took 10 years to do the research. It took about 15 years to do the research and development. So I would say it took about 25 years to do that.
So it's not an overnight process at all.
No.
No. Jerry in Appleton, hi.
Hi. I've been calling and responding to the person that said that he was in a classroom with kids with measles and nobody died. My older brother died of measles. Mm. My other brother was paralyzed for a month.
Oh.
And I was very ill. And I'm incensed, if you will, at the attitude of people about science, and I'm just responding to that call. Thank you.
Yeah, thank you, Jerry. I'm sorry. That's rough, Doctor.
Yeah, you know, I mean, you're scarred by your experiences here. I mean, we had a child just about 6 months ago who died of pneumococcal meningitis, you know, type of bacterial meningitis, for which there's a vaccine. The parents chose not to vaccinate their child. They were sure that the child would never suffer, and they lost their child. It's so hard to watch because medicine, you know, as previous callers have said, certainly has limits, but this isn't one of them. I mean, we know that the germ theory is not a theory anymore. Specific germs cause specific diseases. We know that we can prevent some of them. We have, you know, safe vaccines to do that. And when we choose to put our children at unnecessary risk, it's really hard for me as a doctor to watch that.
I imagine. About a minute left. Gail in Fish Creek. Hi.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. I'll be kind of brief here. I watched the congressional hearings and was very interested in this because I know people who have not vaccinated their children and they have been fine. And I myself, I really have reactions to a lot of things. But what the interesting thing is, what was found was two of the people that were presenting were actually had like 35 years worth of work that they had done with children, just as their professions. One was pediatrician.
Got to get to the point. We only have 20 seconds.
With children, and they found the nutritional properties were essential fatty acids, vitamin A and vitamin D in different variations of depletion in the children would give you the ratio of how difficult or how drastic a reaction was going to be. So with pollutions that we have all over, if we got to the manufacturing pharmaceutical industry and got them to make single dose so they could get those.
All right. We got the point, Dr. Offit. We have about 10 seconds.
You know, again, there's some nutty notions out there about, you know, what it is that you need to have in order to have a successful vaccination in terms of your nutritional status. You know, it's, these studies that are done include children with a whole range of nutritional statuses.
Dr. Offit, thank you so much. You are a wealth of information. Thanks.
Thank you.
Dr. Paul Offit, Chief of Division of Infectious Diseases and Director of Vaccine Education Center at Children's Hospital of Philadelphia. Thanks to KP Whaley for producing this interesting and informative show. We'll be back.